I'm going to tell you a story, and I'm going to move from health indicators to family planning. And it's a story of the use of data to make midterm changes in the intervention. And we don't have anything to disclose. And the story is about, we have a project to integrate the standard days method, which I'll tell you about in a minute, into family planning services. It is a five-year project to scale it up, and we are doing it in five countries at this point: the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Guatemala, the state of Jharkhand in India, Mali and Rwanda, and I'll focus today on Rwanda. The standard days method is a fertility awareness-based methods of family planning. Fertility awareness-based methods is a group of methods that help women identify the days each cycle in which they're most likely to become pregnant. And if they do not want to get pregnant, they do not have unprotected sex on those days. The standard days method specifically identified days 8 to 19 of the cycle as the fertile period for all users in all cycles. It is most appropriate for women that have cycles that usually range between 26 and 32 days, and it's usually provided with cycle beads, which is a string of beads that women can use to monitor where they are in the cycle. I will not get into more detail now, but you can always ask me later if you want. We also have a booth, booth 1314, where you can get more information about our work in the exhibit hall. Rwanda is the most densely populated country in Africa. About 87% of the populations are engaged in agriculture, mostly subsistence. The country experienced a genocide in 1994, where over a million people were killed. That represented about 15% of the population. So imagine every six person you know dying in just a few months. Obviously, it's got huge implications on economy, amongst many other things. And while the economy is gradually rebounding, Rwanda remains one of the poorest countries in the world. It is a paradise, though, today. People are working really, really hard to move forward. In recent years, the government made a very real effort to reduce the total fertility rate and maternal and infant mortality, and part of it is really pushing for more availability and more family planning use, and scaling up of the standard days method is part of this government program. The standard days method was first introduced in Rwanda in 2002 in 13 pilot sites, which included some public health clinics and religious organizations clinics and an NGO. And it was successful, the effort, in that the demand was huge. There was very little family planning method at the available at the time. Huge demand for the methods. Provonet found it method easy to teach, and users found it easy to learn and use and very acceptable. And so a year later, 15 more sites were added. And then in 2004 and 5, Rwanda was one of three countries where we tested the impact of introducing the method on a larger scale in the community, and that was a two-year project with baseline and endline and intervention and control, and results were very positive. And so now it is one of the five countries where we're actually scaling it up to a national scale. This is kind of a roadmap for the scaling up process. And the inputs are all the resources that we have available, so it's things like competent staff, both in DC and in country, partners, the Ministry of Health is important, but other partners as well, funds provided by USAID, as well as leverage funds from other sources, and, of course, cycle beads, which are the visual tools that help users use it. The process relates to what it is that we do, so we do capacity building, we do advocacy efforts, we do supportive supervision. Outputs are the immediate outputs of those efforts. So providers are trained, clinics offer the method, we have IC materials in place, and the outcomes are the changes and the benefits of our program. So the program is available in facilities to users. Providers know how to counsel, how to teach women to use it, and couples know that the method is available. We have many other data sources in addition to those that I'm going to look at today. We have stakeholder interviews, we have more significant change methodology, we look at timelines, but today I will look just at the benchmark monitorings and mostly facility assessment and household surveys. Now, even though it's a huge project, we try not to collect all our own data, but also whenever possible using existing data sources, because otherwise we will never have the funds to do this, to do what we do, where we do, to the scale that we do it. So a bit of a timeline here. We are just finished the third year of the five-year project to scale up. Before that, we had the awareness project where we tested, developed and tested the method. And in June to August of 2007, Macro and the Ministry of Health, the facility assessment, results of that were not yet available for about a year. Even preliminary results were not available for about a year. When the data were collected, we were just ready to start our project, which started in September of 2007. Then, a few months later, there was an interim DHS, and we looked at data from that as well. At the end of year one and two, we look at monitoring results against benchmark that we set to ourselves. Then the preliminary results came up in the beginning of year two of our project for both of those studies. And then we did our own facility assessment as well in April of 2009. So the service provision assessment survey, it's actually a census of all service, all health facilities in the country. And the focus is not family planning, a lot of malaria, a lot of bed nets, a lot of other, all sort of health indicators. And a little bit about family planning. And when the preliminary results came, and like for a year we just went around doing our stuff happily, and then the preliminary results came. And the good news is that the standardized method is indeed included in the study, in the assessment, which took some advocacy to go to Macro, to go to the Ministry of Statistics and tell them, we have this new method, it needs to be included. And that for some reason, they actually in the table gave it its very own column. And out of all the service, the health facilities in the countries, almost three quarters offer family planning. And those are the only ones that we are really interested in. And 76.3% and 55% at the time offered the standardized method. So that's about 55 out of 73, it's about three quarters of the facilities that offered family planning, which is huge. Consider the data were considered before we started our scaling up efforts. So what are we even doing here? This is great, it's almost scaled up, right? 2 months later, we got the preliminary results for the interim DHS. And the table in the facility assessment that I show you was the only table available that included the standardized method in the preliminary results. When this came out, again, through advocacy efforts of ours, the standardized method was included, and not only included, it was included as a modern method, which it is, not as part of the rhythm method, which is considered traditional. And we found that out of married women of reproductive age, 64% have heard of the method. So that's great, our IEC materials and all that work. But only 1% have ever used the method, and only a fraction were using it at the time of the survey. Now, that's okay. Not everyone needs to like it, and maybe women do not want to use it. It's all about choice. But given our previous experience in the country, it didn't seem quite right. So by that time, the full report for the facility assessment came out, and in the attachment at the end, at the appendixes, we found another table that included the standardized method. And that gave us somewhat different pictures. It looked at the commodities. So thanks, Dana, for bringing out commodities. Because what does it mean for the method to be offered? You can see that in 33 quarters of facilities, the commodity for oral contraceptives is there. Most also had the commodities for condom. But only 12% had cycle beads, which explain the disparity between this and how many couples were using it. And you can see that across regions, there was a variation, but it's not, basically it was not offered anywhere. So it brings to the question of what do we mean by offered. We should have looked more closely at the definition that they use. They use the definition that providers are trained in using it, and it is on the list of methods that they use. But it, clearly, it's not offered if the commodity is not really there. So what did we do? We have in Rwanda, because family planning is such a big thing there, there is actually a task force that deals with everything to do with family planning. And so our office manager in Rwanda went and said, listen, we have this problem, what do we do? And JSI Deliver said, we are going to take care of it, and they did. So thanks. Now, at the same time, we already had results from 2 years from our own benchmark monitoring. You can see that the number on the right after the slash is at the beginning of the project what we envision happening through 5 years. So if we look, for example, at commodities and logistics, by the end of year one, which includes also our pre-project efforts through the previous project, we envision that by the end of 5 years, we're going to have 9 systems that include it. By the end of year one, 4 of them we included. By the end of year two, 6 were. Another important one is that the method would be in the management information system, and by the end of year one, it was not, but by the end of year two, it was. And so in April of 2009, we did our own facility assessment to check that what JSI Deliver was actually working. It was very different from the first one in that it was our very own study. So first, we only included facilities that offered family planning, and we did not do a census of them. We did a survey of about a third of them. And our focus was only family planning, no other health indicators, including a big module about the standardized method itself. And we found that 94% of facilities offer the method, so it increased from the 3/4, which is good. Only 8% experienced any stockouts in the past 3 months of the cycle bead, and that compared to about 5% of oral contraceptives and 2% of condoms. So we were not completely alone. It's not quite as good as we would like it, but definitely a huge improvement. The method is now offered. Also, compared to oral contraceptives and condoms for which you need to come back for resupplies, these you only get them once. 96% of trained providers demonstrated correct knowledge of how to offer the method, so we were quite pleased by that. But we did find that there was some confusion regarding eligibility to use the method. We don't ask women to track their cycle length for a few months to see that they are within the 26 to 32-day range for cycle length, and yet some providers did send providers home to track the cycles before giving them the method. So our year three efforts focused on improved training and refresher training with a focus on that. The lessons learned are, first, the importance of using data for midterm corrections, because if we hadn't looked at that data closely, we would have blissfully gone on and had no idea that we are really not achieving what it is that we wanted to achieve, and that we need to be careful how indicators are defined. And of course, keep your eyes for all elements in the system. Thank you. Yes. There is a company called Cycle Technologies that manages this. Mostly, I believe, we're not producing them. This has nothing to do with us. We developed them. We tested them. Cycle Technologies is doing it. I believe they have there's a plant in Hong Kong that does this. India do their own production. There might be somewhere in Africa. I'm really not sure. But you can go to the Cycle. For Rwanda, they were important through commodities. It's their Ministry of Health that does that, together with all other contraceptive commodities. I'm not sure of the technicalities of that.
I think in Rwanda, they're donated by USAID.
I believe so. I'm not sure. But you can go to the Cycle Technologies webpage, too, if you want more, to know where they're actually manufactured. Anything else? Thank you.
Okay, now, we've had all our speakers, right? We have about 20 minutes for a good discussion. There were some questions here of Kathy, I remember.
Yes, I'd like to go back to the zinc toolkit. It was a very nice presentation. And I'm just curious to know, and maybe I missed it, who does the surveys, the different types of quantitative and qualitative? And is there a capacity building component to that? In other words, are the local folks learning how to use tools?
The surveys that I presented in the three countries and the one that's going on in Pakistan have all been implemented under the leadership of me as the research director currently. But what we essentially do is we subcontract a local research firm in a country to do the work. So we do the capacity building when we go to the country to set up the field work. We had the local firm handle recruitment of data collectors, training data collectors, and the logistics, and getting ready to go out to the field. And we usually attend those sessions as sort of a quality control component, but also to work closely with the local research firm leaders to make sure they're clear on the methods that we're, you know, that we want to follow, the sampling procedures, et cetera. So there's an element of kind of, I would call it almost on-the-job capacity building, working with local research firms. And then usually we're on the receiving end once they've handled the field work and data cleaning and entry and all of that. Then we usually do the analysis. Although it depends on the firm's capacity. And if we are working in a country with a firm that has a very strong analytic capacity, a lot of times they'll handle much of the analysis, and then we'll work with them to write our final report.
In the back.
Yes, and a question to you. It seems that supply chain was an issue in the countries you presented. Do you monitor that regularly?
So in Madagascar, supply chain was definitely an issue, and there were some extreme political circumstances that prevented a lot of activities in Madagascar over the period of our program. And so we're still waiting. We're waiting for those political issues to get resolved to be able to do a little more work there. But yes, we do monitor supply chain, not to the level that a supply chain specific project does, but we try to assess where are the bottlenecks and where are the barriers to getting the product supply. But then we typically would work with other projects, such as Deliver, for example, to work on really how do you address those bottlenecks, because that's not in our mandate. But trying, you know, we have a limited realm in the supply side that we're able to address ourselves before we then interact with other counterparts to address those issues.
Yep. Hi, I'm Katie Stouts from Vermont. Thanks a lot for your presentation.
Great.
I was wondering if with the MME data you were able to sort of prioritize and sequence the next steps, because you had your list of next steps and they were most, it seemed like they were mostly focused on the provider. But it also seemed like there might have been, obviously, the need to focus on the supply issue and the system issue, and also the community demand issues. And I was wondering if, using the MNE data, you were actually able to sequence and prioritize.
Well, I think it really depends on, it needs to be prioritized in each individual setting, is what it kind of come down to, because we have such different environments that we work in, and it may be that in, you know, if we start working in Kenya, for example, or Nigeria is another country on the list, to get involved with. Until we go in there and really kind of do that formative research and understand the lay of the land and figure out, is this country going to need more support on the supply side, or is it going to need more support on building demand? It's hard to say, I think, from the outset. So we're just at that point right now where we're identifying countries that are interested in getting us involved with increasing access to and use of zinc. And we'll be using the toolkit then to do that formative research and then lay out the plans and prioritize at that point, I think.
So in these lists that you presented, that's this is,
this is kind of just big picture, you know, the toolkit itself is quite new. And for us, that was a big achievement. In fact, I know we discussed briefly this idea of doing something more like an impact evaluation. At this point, even just being able to do high quality baseline and inline survey is a big accomplishment in our eyes. Because a lot of times we don't have funding to do really rigorous high-quality population-based survey, for example, and we've been very fortunate to be able to do that in our countries and to have the support from our client to do that. So I think this was more, you know, overall, we're trying to get the toolkit out there approved and in use, not just by us, but by other Zinc programs implemented by other partners, but with the understanding that it really needs to, the program approach as well as the toolkit itself needs to be adapted to local conditions.
Hi, question. Thank you, everybody, for your presentations. My name is Elvira Barakotia. And the question is for the three of you. I wonder how the monitoring and evaluation tools that you've been using, the toolkit, the data, how is that going to be transferred to the country? How is that going to be sustainable? Is the toolkit, for instance, being used by the Rwanda supply system?
Well, speaking about the Zinc toolkit, we work with our local partners in countries, again, to introduce them to it, to get them involved in the local field work, the research, and to get the buy-in from the Ministry of Health, the appropriate team at the ministry, so that, again, they're aware of it, they can see its value, especially when we provide some high-quality data to them and say, look, here's what we found, and here's what we suggest we do based on data now. And so far, we've had very positive responses. So we do try to work from that institutionalization angle and hope that it will be continued to be seen as valuable and used. It's in a format that it can be easily adapted. You don't have to use the whole toolkit. So we hope that that makes it a little more manageable for sustainability.
And for our performance measures guide, I mean, I think the idea was just to sort of consolidate work that's been done over the past couple of decades in developing some of these indicators. It's not a tool in the same sense, although we do have tools where we actually apply these indicators. But the idea was to make a guide available to people working in supply chain management in developing countries. In the countries where we work, similarly, where we work directly with the ministries of health. A lot of times we actually have staff seconded to the Ministry of Health, and so we would work with them to select indicators that they would find useful for managing their supply chains. Last summer, I spent a few weeks in Ghana, actually, when I was developing this, actually going to the indicators with people that worked at all levels of the supply chain there to really validate them and talk to them about what would be useful in your setting. Because some of them are private sector indicators, and they may not be applicable in these settings. And so it was really a useful exercise, you know, starting from the high level in the capital and going all the way out to a rural site and saying, you know, what types of indicators could you use to monitor your performance? What would help you to really improve the performance of the supply chain to make sure that commodities are available to the clients that need them, whether it's zinc or bed nets or cycle beads?
Mm-hmm. For us, our efforts are more with advocacy. When I showed you results from the macros, the SPAS and the DHS that include the standardized method, that's because we advocated for it. It's not a given. The method is now offered in more than 30 countries worldwide, and few of them actually include. Whenever we hear in any of the countries that we work in that there's going to be a new DHS or a new SPAS, we need to advocate both in country and centrally with Macro International here to include the standardized method, to include it as a model method, to include it when they look for commodities, so that we just get the information that we need that way.
My name is Bola Jifakonda, and I'm from JESA. One of the findings from the presenters, from Ms. Sana, is that inter-agency collaboration and coordination does matter, both in terms of project monitoring and monitoring for results. And so my question is this something that's been prioritized in programs as a method for achieving results? you know, if not, why not? Thank you.
Other?
I have one sort of along that same line. I'm from Management Sciences for Health. I'm Sally Craig Huber, and I'm I've been struck by all three of these presentations that they're about systems changes, and that they're focusing on the importance of scaling up good services. But what I didn't hear in any of them was the link with health outcomes. I mean, what difference are any of these things going to make in terms of the ultimate health of the country? And I'm really putting that as a challenge, because I think all of us who are funded by USAID anyway, or US government, are seeing that the Global Health Initiative is really going to start putting pressure on us to document the health results and our contribution to them. So I'm just curious whether, you know, we didn't go that far in any
presentations. Let's encourage the APT Association to put in a strong proposal to do this, to save children's lives through oral rehydration.
That was actually, in my presentation, I actually mentioned health outcomes a number of times. That was the whole point of the presentation, was that getting the products, making sure that the products are available to clients results in better health outcomes. So,
but measuring that, I think, is a challenge for all of us.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's where this link between, like you said, between different partners and, you know, the types of surveys that are done, making sure that they're collecting information that can provide that information is really important.
And beyond the big picture of health outcomes, that there's a lot of literature that if there's more choice, then there's better health outcomes, at least in family planning, which is where I'm coming from. But we're also doing a lot of studies on different small parts of it. For example, this tool, and we found through a variety of studies that it's a very empowering tool for women to have things that and it's encouraged communication between the couple, for example. It empowers women in different ways. Just the fact that they know about their fertilities makes them, and it has implications beyond family planning use. And again, we're not measuring the outcome of that, but you know, their project to, because that's not the scale that we are working on. But there are projects to empower women. There are projects to increase male involvement. There are projects to increase family planning use. All of those things, we know, or we hope we do, would improve health outcomes. That, yes, we need to measure.
I have a sort of a personal type question, but I would think that couples practicing the standard days methods would really have a more satisfying life. Is there any efforts to measure that?
Well, we cannot measure how satisfied they are with their life, but we do know that we did have a study that showed improved marital relationship. I mean, many of the places where we work, women cannot talk to their husbands about sex. Uh-huh. They just cannot. But this gives them a tool to do that, in that, you know, the white beads, which is the fertile days, they glow in the dark. And so, and there are many men who take on the challenge. There's a ring here that you need to move, and they move it for them instead of the wife, so it gives them a sense of control. And so we heard, we with focus groups and interviews in a number of countries, in many different studies, with users, about including men, that they think that the marital relationship is stronger because they can talk more now about things that they could never communicate. Even if they don't talk, even if it's non-verbal communication, they feel the difference. How that affects the satisfaction with their life, I don't know. I hope it's a factor.
I think it's also just the fact of adding another choice. Exactly. There are many women who, you know, are averse to taking a modern method of, using another modern method of contraception, like the pills or injectables or something, because maybe religious beliefs, or maybe their fear of side effects, or maybe they've had experience with side effects and they're afraid to use those methods. So it's another option that women have to take control of their fertility.
Well, it's really been a fine session. I'm very pleased to be here and have a part of it. Let me mention to you all that A few of us are going to get together tomorrow at 7 a.m. in room 604 to talk about evaluation, talk about good, solid evaluation. I mean, as far as I read things, AID has never done a good experimental evaluation. And maybe AID's first real experimental evaluation will be headed by Chad. And, okay. Any last comments?